So over the next couple weeks, I feel like I'm being indulged slightly. Yes, and Vajrajyoti shaking her head, yes. Because what I wanted to do was, well, one is I really enjoy building a theme. I like the prospect of kind of speaking one week and being able to build the next week so that you don't have to pack it all in 1 week. So I kind of felt like this topic, it needed a bit of unpacking. It needed a bit more time than an hour. And also needed a little bit of time maybe to soak in. I think poetry is something you almost need to sit with a little to kind of get a feel for. And the other thing is, I have come more recently, later on in Buddhism, to really, really appreciate the Chinese, the Japanese Zen poets. And for that matter, also, I've grown to appreciate the Tibetan, the poetry of Tibetan puja, and just even some of their commentary, some of the commentary they write. It's just gorgeous language. So I kind of wanted to share what I think is a rich source of inspiration in the Buddhist tradition. And the other thing was that when I first got involved, I basically had a very scientific background. And I for whatever reason, when I was in Cambridge, which is kind of was like my going forth, I left America and went to Cambridge to join Wind Horse Trading. And my two best friends ended up being poets. And it was sort of like they would write poems and talk about, and I could never figure out what they were going on about. I couldn't get it. And I think it goes back to my mild childhood, because for me, poems were always about rhyming and a certain number of syllables in each line, and I could never do it. I copied a poem here. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more. Which is Edgar Allan Poe, the Raven, Start of the Raven. But, you know, I could never do that. You know, kind of nearly napping and gently tapping and stuff. I mean, that was just beyond me. I could add two and two, and I could divide and multiply and do derivatives, but I couldn't do language. So I sort of just never really got introduced to it. And people never, I never had anybody that kind of took me below the surface of the rhyming and the syllables. Until I got in touch with the Tree Ratna community. Sangha Rachta, a founder of our movement, was very into poetry. He actually wrote a whole bunch of poetry. And as a gift to some extent, and also so that we would all have access to it, we published all the poems. Wind Horse Publications published them all in a really thick volume of complete poems of Sangha Rachta. In poetry, I started to realize that what poetry did was it attempted to point at an experience that kind of goes beyond the words. In poetry, I started to realize that poetry was a lot more open. It was less defined, and therefore, since it was less almost logical, less analytical, it actually had the potential to speak about things that go beyond a bit more easily. So what I found was that as my Buddhist practice was deepening, I was starting to kind of get introduced to, starting to find poems that I liked. So I found like some American poets, particularly William Stafford. Somebody introduced me to William Stafford. I bought his collected poems, and I just sort of just loved it. And I think there was something about him being an American and kind of some of the symbolism he used, which just spoke to me. And also some of the contemporary poetry I read was really powerful, particularly Ted Hughes's translation of Ovid, Tales of Ovid. I just was like really amazed by the use of language and stuff, and I got interested in it. And also Seamus Heaney translated Beowulf, and that kind of, you know, and I think it was when I started seeing a more contemporary vernacular, if that's the right word, yeah, that it sort of really captured me. And then I started running into translated poems, which I almost liked even more, because sometimes it's quite difficult to get the meter and the rhyme in a translation. So sometimes the translation has to just be a bit without that. And I also discovered that some poets have actually, and that these can go poets back, you know, 1,000 years, would rebel against the technical structure of poetry. You know, they actually were kind of advocating the importance of the meaning and the symbolism rather than the structure. And to be honest, Cold Mountain was one of those poets. And I'll kind of share with you a little later. He was very much not a polished poet. And in one of his poems, he actually says, well, you know, I don't know how to do all this stuff. Of course, while he's saying that, he's doing it. So he's a bit of a smartass, too. But, but either way, so I started getting interested in poems. So with respect to Cold Mountain, I don't know why I bought the collected poems of Cold Mountain. He was with respect to contemporary detail, he's, well, I'll pass this out. Where is it? So there should be enough of these, and there should be some extras. But try to stay with me rather than kind of reading the handout, if that's okay. I mean, it's challenging, but I can see. I'll notice. But the reason I'm passing this out is because there's a picture which is kind of it's a fair. Kind of photocopy of it. It's a lot subtler in the image. But Cold Mountain is frequently portrayed as a crazy, wild-eyed mountain man. In this picture, he's got his finger pointing up to the sky, and that's actually an allusion to the finger pointing to the moon. Yeah? Although, that wasn't around in Cold Mountain's day. Some of you are still getting them. And also, he's pictured in this picture with a friend of his. He had two friends. One of his friends was an orphan boy that was found in the street and brought in the monastery. And the other friend was a person from the monastery. And they were a bit, they were known, at least historically, as being a bit crazy and a bit of the rebels of the monastery. So, has everybody got a sheet? Good. They were known as the rebels of the monastery. In the pictures, they're frequently laughing. Yeah. Sometimes in pictures, he's shown with a scroll that's got nothing on it. And a lot of his poems just are kind of almost poking fun at. And a lot of the stories about him were poking fun at, where he would poke fun at monks and then run away and stuff like that. So it turns out that Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac, who we were just talking about earlier, picked up on Cold Mountain's poems. And Gary Snyder, who's you know, that Beat Generation, he actually translated some of the poems for when he was doing his graduate degrees out in California, about 28 of the poems. And he got Jack Kerouac to dedicate the Dharma Bums, the book, to Cold Mountain. If you want to see what Cold Mountain's life was like, go on to YouTube and type in Into White Clouds. And it's a documentary about Chinese hermits, mountain hermits, who live in this day and age and live in the mountains. It's actually quite a good documentary. But Cold Mountain, he was first translated in 57 by an academic. And then soon after that, in the late 50s, came Snyder with another 28 poems or so. Then Burton Watson translated about 100 poems in the early 60s. Red Pine translated poems in the 80s. And then there's been a couple more academic translations. But historically, what he did was he'd write his poems on rocks. So he'd just write them on rocks and just leave them. So they were kind of like in nature, just in the countryside around his cave where he lived. And it was probably 7th or 8th century. We know where the cave was because we know where the mountain was that he took his name from, which is called Mountain. And we know where some of the streams are that he refers to in his poetry. And in that cave right now lives a farmer whose, I think, wife left him, and he just farms a little plot, and he just lives there. So, but other than that, most of the details about Han Shan, we actually don't know, and we can't really confirm for sure. There's debates about the exact date of when he lived. There's debates about whether he's actually a single person or not. Some people think it's multiple people, and they just collected all the poems together. And there's also no conclusion about the attitude behind his poems. Some people think that his poems were sort of every day. Others take them as holy and harmonious, and there's a big debate goes on. So it's really interesting. One translator actually suggested that his life is so vague that he should be regarded more as a state of mind rather than flesh and blood. I thought that was interesting. So the other thing, before we get into his poems, well, translation and his poems, is to note that the celebration of wilderness, which is very common in Chinese poetry, was not that common. It really kind of came out of Chinese poetry as like that's where it happened first. And I think that was, you got poems. I was reading, this isn't my theory. This is from a Chinese anthology poetry book. So we can take this with authority, that is true. But what it said was that the poems that were about nature usually were about a domesticated or a fearsome nature, a nature which was to be avoided or a nature which was tamed. But the idea of a wild nature which was to be enjoyed was not common, particularly not in European literature. So some of this poetry, 7th, 8th century, is some of the first poetry to do that. All right. So on to his poems. So what I'm thinking of doing for the next 3 weeks is to actually, I've got, this handout I gave you is just kind of filled with poems. So what I'd like to do is read them and kind of look at what they tell us and look at some of the lines and stuff. Vajrajyoti warned me that I shouldn't interpret the poems for you, so I will try not to. That poems should be interpreted by you rather than me interpreting them for you. So I will try and do that. But a little bit about translation first. It's interesting because one of the things I was reading was there's a lot of talk with academic literature about how you need to know the language that a poem is experienced, that a poem's written in order to truly get into it. So it says, there's a quote here, a translation can only bring the reader to the threshold of a new experience, but one must acquire the original language if one is to avail oneself fully of that experience. So I think that's interesting, because what that's telling us is that in order to understand Han Shan's poems, you know, you could say that you need to know Chinese. But the interesting thing, I think, is that Buddhism is also a language. Yeah, Buddhism's a framework for understanding things. And in order to understand Han Shan's poems, you almost really need to be a Buddhist to understand them. Yeah, and since we're exploring Buddhism, to the extent that we understand Buddhism, we've got an inroad into Han Shan's poems. The other thing was a quote I found which said, it's very important to be honest about the interpretive framework you're using with poems and translation work. So when you're an academic, you should say that you're an academic, like you're translating them because you know Chinese and you love poetry. And if you're a Buddhist, be clear that you're a Buddhist and you're translating on that basis, or you're translating on some other basis. And what someone warned, I thought this was great, he said, you know, the question is, are audiences getting the translation they deserve? You know, but also he said, are translations getting the audience they deserve? Yep. So the Buddha made that point in the Chöngi Sutta in the Pali Canon. He said that in order to preserve the truth, it's very important that you state the basis on which you think something's true. So similarly, I think it's really important to realize who's translating poems and stuff. And another thing I'd say about translation work is just that we really don't know what was going on in Han Shan's head. You know, we don't know what his experience was. We really don't. We have no idea. So some people interpret him in one way and others interpret him kind of less generously or more generously. And I'll give you some examples. So please turn the page. So this first poem at the top is, I think, one of his most famous poems. And the poem goes, and I'm going to be reading the poem to the left. My mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say? My mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say? And just to show you, kind of, that's from a Buddhist. That's a translation from Red Pine. And I just think that's just amazingly evocative of the state of mind that you can get into. And I love the line, nothing can compare, what more can I say? But Burton Watson, who's not a Buddhist, but he's a lover of Asian literature and an academic, his translation was, my mind is like the autumn moon, shining clear, or clean and clear in the green pool. No, that's not a good comparison. Tell me, how can I explain? So when you read those two, can you feel the difference between the two? You know, they're just very stark difference. Very stark difference. And there's a lot of generosity, at least from a Buddhist perspective, in Red Pine's translation. You know, it's in Burton Watson's, for me at least, it has a feeling of kind of tentativeness and hesitancy and kind of not sure, whereas Red Pine's, you know, nothing can compare, is more like kind of planting a flag. You know, it's like planting a flag on the moon or something. You know, you like saying, I know this. Yeah, but I think the next translation is even more telling of what an academic and someone without sympathies for Buddhism and understanding of Buddhism can do to a poem. So on the left, a visitor criticized Han. Okay, well, either way. A visitor criticized Han Shanzu, saying, your poems are most unreasonable. From my reading of the ancients, it is clear to me that they were not ashamed to be poor and humble, as you are. I laughed at his words and replied, how easy it is to talk. I wish you were as poor as I now am. You would soon see then what an important thing money is. So from a Buddhist perspective, I don't know, what do you think? And now Red Pine's translation on the right. Someone sighed, cold mountain, sir, your poems possess no sense. And then there's a lot of debate about who's saying what. So this is Han Shan. I said for the ancients, poverty was no disgrace. To this he answered, laughing, such talk is poorly reasoned. To which Han Shan says, well, sir, then be as you are with money your concern. Completely different. Mm-hmm. Completely different. It's interesting, too, because, and you have to kind of keep reading, but as I researched that poem a bit, there's a Japanese scholar, because the Japanese really love Han Shan. A Japanese scholar actually supported the first translation, but said that money is a metaphor for enlightenment, And poverty is a metaphor for samsara and ignorance. And so this is a play. This is a play that's much more complex than you'd think, where he's actually claiming that enlightenment and awakening is really important through the metaphor of riches and stuff. I think that's too complex. I actually prefer Red Pine's translation. So I want to move on then to a third poem, which I think is Han Shan taking it to his critics. Yep. So I'm going to read the Burton Watson translation here. Yep, because I think it's clearer. A certain scholar named Mr. Wang was laughing at my poems for being so clumsy. "Don't you know you can't have two accents here? And this line has too many beats. You don't seem to understand meter at all, but toss in any word that comes to mind." "I laugh too, Mr. Wang, when you make a poem, like a blind man trying to sing of the sun." So I think in this poem what you get is you get Red Pine obviously saying that you know, in a way, what he's singing about, what he's writing his poems about, it isn't something that everybody's experiencing. And so when his critics are kind of commenting on his poetry, he actually, to tell you the truth, in this poem, he manages to get all the accents right and all the beats right. So this is where he's being a bit clever. So he did get it right, and he's getting it right and kind of at the same time saying he's being criticized for not getting it right. But in the end, he's saying, "Yes, but you know, you don't see what I'm pointing at." You know, I love Red Pine's "A Blind Man's Song About the Sun." I like that a bit more. It's the bottom line on the left.
Left is Burton.
Oh yeah, that's right. I've got them on the other way around here. It's labeled correctly on that sheet. So when it comes to poetry and translations, particularly of Chinese and Japanese works, I would really encourage you to realize that they are translations, and to realize that someone translated them. It's a point that Sangharakshita makes, is that when we read translations, we should really read translations that are by Buddhists. Yeah. So yeah. So now, do you feel kind of appropriately filled in and eager to read only translations by Buddhists? Yeah? No. Well, I didn't expect you would, actually. But. Excellent. He always tests me. He's testy. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is just go through some of Cold Mountain's poems and tell you a little bit about his life. Yeah. So the first one I'll read. I recall 20 years ago my slow steps ending at Kuching. The people at Kuching Temple agreed Cold Mountain was a fool. And why was I a fool? Because I couldn't reason. But I didn't know myself, so how could they? I bowed my head and didn't ask. Why ask anyway? People still reproached me. This is something I know well. And though I didn't answer, I came out ahead. Most people think that Cold Mountain was probably an official. And the officials in Chinese history were highly educated. The emperors were sort of the powerful and hereditary kind of rulers. But all the administration was done by a very highly educated official class. And the officials were the ones who wrote most of the poetry. Almost all the body of ancient Chinese poetry is done by officials. Those officials sometimes would change allegiances. So they'd be hired on by some emperor, and they'd have their job. And if the emperor changed, which it did, sometimes they would change with the new emperor. And when that would happen, of course, if it changed back, they'd usually be out of a job. Also, sometimes the emperors weren't really that great. They were quite morally decadent, and they just like taxed the people quite heavily or stuff. And at those times, sometimes in the poetry was a way of criticizing politically without criticizing directly. So you could say something without saying it. And it didn't always escape the eyes of the emperor, and sometimes you'd get banished. Other times you wouldn't, but frequently you would. There is a theory that Cold Mountain got banished and that he was on the hide. He'd run away and he was hiding on the mountain. But when he made it to the temple, it seems like it just didn't work. And I think it's interesting. He did kind of live a different life. He in those days, there's some poems I'll read next week about his criticisms of the monastic tradition. But he really he wanted to have that genuine relationship with the transcendental. He wanted to have a genuine relationship of awakening. And I think he felt that the monasteries were just sort of schools. And in this poem, when it says, "Because I couldn't reason," well, I don't think he knew this. He didn't know the suttas that well. He probably wasn't much of a scholar. And for that reason, he babbled probably. Probably, you can tell from his poems, he's probably quite an eccentric character. And I think he just didn't fit in. So the next poem. "I usually live in seclusion, but sometimes I go to Chongqing to call on the venerable Fen Can and to visit with Master Shi Te. But I go back to Cold Cliff alone, observing an unspoken agreement. I follow a stream that has no spring. The spring is dry, but not the stream." So he lives in seclusion on the mountain, and he goes back to the temple to visit his two friends. The one friend is named Pickup, Master Shi Te, which is this orphan kid that just they found on the street and end up working in the kitchen. And the other one is the venerable Fen Can. And all the stories are about those three. But I think what's interesting here is you start getting some of his teachings in this poem. And in particular, "I follow a stream that has no spring. The spring is dry, but not the stream." Now, does anybody have any idea about what that might mean?
It's a koan.
A koan. Yep, could be. It is a koan of sorts. Well, I think this sort of stuff is really tough to decipher, to be honest. So unless you've got kind of like someone to interpret the poem for you, it can be tough. So in this, and this is Red Pine says this, but it really kind of is quite interesting to reflect on. The stream is karma. The spring is the passions. So I follow a stream. I follow a karma. I follow a way, or I follow a kind of a path that has no spring, which isn't fed by the passions. Yeah? The passions are dry, but not the stream. You know, I think it's a really interesting metaphor, because Sangharakshita talks about the spiritual life as something where, even though as you practice the spiritual life, the passions dry up, your self-centeredness dries up, you don't lose initiative. Yeah? So there's still that stream keeps going. You still act. You still engage with the world. But somehow, your motivation for doing it is not about you anymore. So the spring dries up, yeah? But if you think about that, one of the koans people run across is that when they think about Buddhist tradition, they kind of wonder, well, if desire dries up, well, what'll I do? You know, how will I engage with the world? You know, because I'll just be kind of completely disconnected from it. And here what Han Shan saying in his own experience was that even though the spring dries up, the stream, you know, but not the stream. And I just think that's really lovely sort of line, and it gives me a lot to reflect on. Yep. So here's another one which is kind of similar, which is I reached Cold Mountain and all cares stopped. No idle thoughts remained in my head. Nothing to do, I write poems on rocks and trust the current like an unmoored boat. So I really love that image of trusting the current. So, and I think this once again is where kind of like Red Pine's translation as a Buddhist is different from a non-Buddhist, and Gary Snyder's translation is right next to it. It says, once at Cold Mountain, troubles cease, no more tangled, hung-up mind. I idly scribble poems on the rock cliff, taking whatever comes like a drifting boat. So I think a few choices of words there. One is, I idly scribble poems. Yeah? And also, like a drifting boat. Drifting is not actually a positive word, I think, in English. It's like it implies like having no direction. You know, whereas trusting the current like an unmoored boat is a lot different. It's being taken by a current, just allowing something to move us, yeah? And not having anything tying us down. You know, we're not anchored to anything. We're not kind of anchored really to the passions. We're not anchored by craving and hatred. Yeah? So the image of the unmoored boat.
It's quite different to somebody idly scribbling on a rock.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I scribble on rocks.
Yeah, that's
And dirt.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's very different.
Oh, mindset.
Yeah. So, continuing on, basically, Cold Mountain also is frequently used in his poetry as a metaphor. It points beyond. So it seems like he's talking about the mountain, but he's not. He's talking about something else. So in this next poem, people ask the way to Cold Mountain, but roads don't reach Cold Mountain. In summer, the ice doesn't melt, and the morning fog is too dense. How did someone like me arrive? Our minds are not the same. If they were the same, you would be here. And another one. Who takes the Cold Mountain road, takes a road that never ends. The rivers are long and piled with rocks. The streams are wide and choked with grass. It's not the rain that makes the moss slick, and it's not the wind that makes the pines moan. Who can get past the tangles of the world and sit with me in the clouds? The two lines there that I think I've made bold are two, you know, it's not the rain that makes the moss slick and it's not the wind that makes the pines moan. Reminded me of a story by Hui Neng, where Hui Neng, who is a Chinese sage too, like fifth patriarch, so it might have been before Han Shan, but Hui Neng kind of came to this monastery and these monks were arguing. They were looking at a flagpole. The monks were arguing about whether it's the flag that's moving or the wind that's moving. Yeah, and they were arguing. And Hui Neng came up and he says, no, it's not the wind that's moving, it's not the flag that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. So I think Han Shan's pointing at that in this, that it's not the rain that makes the moss slick, and it's not the wind that makes the pines moan. So Cold Mountain is a state of mind. And he was not popular, Cold Mountain. So supposedly in this poem, you get a little bit of his humor, but also a little bit of what he might have suffered. So they laugh at me. Hey, farm boy, your face is a little thin, your hat isn't high enough, and your belt is far too tight. It's not that I don't know the trends. When you're broke, you can't catch up. One day I'll be rich and stick a stupa on my head. And a stupa is a kind of a Buddhist like monument. So I mean, in a way, here he's using riches to mean awakening. So one day I'll awaken and then I'll stick a stupa on my head. But also you get a sense of how direct he was in this next poem. Cold Mountain speaks these words as if he were a madman. Whoop, all right. Cold Mountain speaks these words as if he were a madman. He tells people what he thinks. Thus he earns their wrath. But a straight mind means straight words, and a straight mind holds nothing back. Crossing the river of death, who's that jabbering fool? The road to the grave is dark, and karma holds the reins. So he was obviously someone who'd speak straight words with a straight mind, and kind of, I think, was, you know, he did get a bit of criticism for that. And the last poem, I did have some poems. Well, the last one about popularity is the one that starts, "People laugh. People laugh about my poems. My poems are not elegant enough. They don't need Chen Swan's comments, much less Mao Hang's explanations. I don't mind few understand me. Those who know one's voice are rare. If we had no fa or soul, my disease would surely spread. One day I'll meet someone with eyes, then my poems will plague the world." So what this poem's alluding to is that when it says, if we had no fa or soul, those are literary devices in Chinese poetry at the time. And basically, Chen Swan's comments and Mao Hang's explanations, they were literary critics at the time. So what he's saying is that, you know, I don't need the literary critics to like my poetry. And for that matter, if the judgment of poetry wasn't on the basis of these literary devices like rhyming and syllables, well, actually, you know, my disease would surely spread. So people would read his poems and follow the teachings and stuff. So, and then what I've done is I've included four other poems at the end about the joys of nature. And I just sort of included them there. I'll leave you to read them. What I kind of like to do is stop now, because it's been kind of a whirlwind tour through some of his poems. And I'd like to hear if any of the lines kind of were evocative or moving for you. And also maybe we can look at the poem on the front page together if anybody's got some sense of what that might be about. Yeah, I like a magic pearl. The Dogen, one of Dogen's essays, he's a Japanese Buddhist teacher, is One Bright Pearl. So there's a lot of, I think pearls are like moons, aren't they? They're just quite they're lustrous, they're kind of, they're beautiful. Pearl of the mind is something that you sometimes read. What's everybody think?
Well, the interesting thing is it's not that he doesn't see anything. He sees, in a way, the whole play of lights and shadows flashing across my mind. But somehow they don't have any power, or he just sees them for what they are. Whereas we just get caught up in them. And these things have more power over us. His relationship with that, with his experience, is very different to our relationship with our experience. Yes, perspective or an awareness that goes beyond the ordinary.
One of the ways that you could read not one dharma is like from a the Chinese were more Mahayanists, so they, you know, the Theravadan tradition kind of had this idea that you could find these basic molecules of practice in a way, and basic molecules of the mind. And one of the ways of taking, you know, not one dharma is say there's no basic truths, there's no basic principles of reality that you can your analysis ends at. So not one dharma appears for me could be a kind of a statement about insubstantiality, and how in the Mahayana that statement of insubstantiality is taken to the extreme. There's nothing substantial. What? Like the Heart Sutra, yeah.
When did he live?
7th or 8th century, probably, but they don't know. Could be anywhere from 6th to 9th. Yeah. Yep. I think Taoism and Buddhism are very hard to separate in China. Yeah.
The poem about money is really quite interesting with the two translations, because not only do they say things in different ways, but they actually turn it around. I mean, it's difficult to believe that wasn't, you know, clear in the original.
Yeah.
I mean, in one it says, the ancients, the critic is saying the ancients weren't ashamed to be poor. Yeah. Well, on the other, it is Col Martin who's saying the ancients. I mean, very different.
Yeah. I think that's a really great example of how translation can, you can really almost, you can see people's values coming through in the translation. I did read one review of that where this. It was somebody writing this review, and she kind of went on and she said, you know, well, of course money's important. Everybody knows money's important. Why wouldn't he be interested in money?
the poem on the front page reminds me of a little of my uncle who lives solitary in Mount Summers in Cambridge. And I sort of, it just gave me the same sort of feeling I get when I visit him, that he sort of just lives by himself. He does whatever he wants, really. Great time gardening. I don't know, it's different to was talking about, like that feeling that he sort of loves living by himself and just free by himself in a way.
And do you think when he says that my true home is on Cold Mountain, do you think he's talking about a state of mind or a place?
It's probably a state of mind, but it could be a place as well.
Yeah.
I think it's both. I think that that first bit's on two levels. In the first level, it's saying, when I'm in seclusion, when I'm on my beautiful mountain, I'm out of trouble. We know he told us he'd get some trouble in the monastery, and I'm away from everything, and then Cold Mountain's also a state of mind. Mm. I think it's both at the same time.
What do you?
Is that what his name means? Han Chan?
Yeah, Cold Mountain. Yeah. What about the last line? I can go anywhere, everywhere is perfect. It's free. Anybody like to be like that?
But also he's at peace with himself.
Yeah, probably.
I feel like it's not literal. Like he can go anywhere. I feel like it's material.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It could also be like the whole imagery around the magic pearl, that it's sort of a metaphor for renunciation, going forth, letting go of all the attachments, and then everything belongs to you, as it were, once you renounce possession. And attraction. So it's not a real pearl, obviously, but it's, you know, what appears when you give up everything, and it's, you know, you have everything.
Absolutely.
I think that poem is quite accessible. There's just one line that I read it in the same way we put it in there, which is, images leave no trace when they vanish. Do you see how that connects in with anything else?
Does anybody want to stab on that one?
There's no emotional attachment, so the next image arises.
Yeah?
I think maybe he's saying the arising and falling away of all phenomena.
The
whole of that poem.
Yep.
I love that one.
Which one?
That one.
There is the kind of the traditional metaphor of the mirror-like wisdom too, and in the mirror-like wisdom, things are said to rise and fall, but your mind's like a mirror, such that when things come in front of the mirror, they're reflected in the mirror, but then when they and they go, the mind doesn't continue to carry them.
It's very cold because it's Cold Mountain, and this is the early morning mists rising above the mountains, and you can't see a thing. Most of the mist and fog on the Cold Mountain.
That's a bit like that metaphor for the Buddha being the trackless one. Really
yep. Yep.
Leaving no tracks.
Yep.
No negative action.
Yep. So that what Vajrajyoti is referring to is some lines from the Dhammapada on the Buddha about the Buddha being the trackless one. It's beautiful. Yeah.
I sort of thought of that with reach out of beyond the reach of trouble, because as the patients rise, as the people around us like get into trouble, and that's what leads.
Just go,
you can watch it come and go without leaving a trace in the world or
other
people.
Really, Papa misses that he's really detached, he's not clinging on, but he's still curious to watch the world. He hasn't shut himself away in his cave and blocked the world out. He still roams the whole universe with his mind. You know, he's still enjoying seeing existence, but he's not caught up in it.
It's when later when he talks, doesn't he, about if they were the same, you would be here. Was there more of a tradition of
not transportation so much, but in terms of that meditative practices where you were engaging with others, sort of...
In like Tonglen?
Well, maybe, but in terms of that transporting yourself, I remember talking with a taxi driver in Bali who was assuring me that he could... He would journey places in his meditation practice.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't run across anything that suggested that, but then I didn't see a lot of commentary on these poems. I didn't read a lot of commentary on it.
You didn't have a time machine?
No. No. I mean, yeah. I think the only thing I did notice that was interesting was that Red Pine was noting that the place where Han Shan lived, actually there was never ice, and also there wasn't fog. So, yeah. So with this poetry, I'll end there. But do read the poems at the end about the joy of being in nature. I think some of them are really lovely, and particularly because I think that in New Zealand, the love of nature is very real. You know, and that might be why I like Han Shan, is because I like wilderness, I like wild nature, I like that. You know, and so I like these poems that kind of evoke that and value it. But with these poems, you know, I'd be interested in just you kind of having a chance to look at them. Next week, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull more of his poems. So the idea is next week to do some of his poems that were a bit more about the situation he sees the world in. And it's kind of some of his poems around impermanence and youth and greed and stuff like that. But also some of his poems about just that offer metaphors for samsara and also the path. And I'm going to share one poem with you, if I can find it.
I just say before you do that those poems about nature, they support my theory about the fog, actually. The first one says, I just traveled south past yesterday, and the one below that says, barefoot in the fog.
So, you were a lawyer, were you, Richard?
I know.
So, okay, thank you. So, to finish, there's a particular poem I like, because I think it's a bit, he's kind of, you know, he's definitely kind of, he wants to encourage us to practice, you know, and he really wants to, you know, he uses a lot of metaphors he uses for what's possible, are very beautiful metaphors. And, but there's one poem where, I'll just read it first. All of you are like priceless gems aboard a rotting ship at sea. In front, the mast is gone. In back, there is no rudder. Heading wherever the wind may blow, moving with the waves, how will you reach shore? Don't just sit there stiff. And I sort of, I mean, well, that's kind of like the poems I'm going to be sharing with you next week. You know, sitting there stiff is basically just meditation, sitting in meditation. It's an allusion to that, which a lot of people just meditated but didn't actually practice outside that. They just sat there stiff. But you are all a priceless gems. I just love that. All priceless gems aboard a rotting ship at sea. Yeah, it's such a great, yeah. So... either way, I hope you find his poetry interesting enough to come back. But next week we'll explore some more poems and introduce you to a little more of Han Shan. That's it.